I am Eric Von Zipper, and I come here to tell you that these beach bums is bums.
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're actually heading out of the studio, straight to the beach at Coney Island.
Lots of sand, lots of water, not just damp sand, but like soupy sand.
We're going out there to feel the sand between our toes, to hear the surf, to watch all the greasy, half-naked people lounging around.
We can see 20, 30, who knows how many mermaids.
And a perfect day at the beach isn't complete without some great music, so we'll have our very own live band, My Favorites, They Might Be Giants, to play their specially crafted beachy tunes just for us. That is all ahead today in Studio 360, right after this.
You're listening to the podcast of PRI Studio 360, where each week, Kurt Anderson brings you great stories and conversation about creativity, pop culture, and the arts. Studio 360 can be heard on public radio stations across America. Please help support the show by becoming a member of your local station. Visit studio360.org to find out more.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and this is Studio 360. Before we talk to They Might Be Giants and hear them play their special custom-composed Studio 360 beach show songs, we're going to take a look at design for the real world right here on the sands of Coney Island. Stephen Heller is with me today under the umbrella. Steve Heller is a designer and critic and a frequent contributor to Design for the Real World. Welcome to the beach, Stephen.
Hi, Kurt. Great to be here.
So there's a big, beautiful beach here with stone jetties and big piers and children digging and gambling across the sands. But when Coney Island was really built 100 or more years ago, it was something grander and special and singular, wasn't it?
Coney Island was the fantasy world. It was built on the model of the World's Fairs, which were the fairs that projected the future. The parachute jump is the Eiffel Tower of Coney Island. It was originally built for the 39 World's Fair for the Lifesaver Company, and it was in their entertainment zone. Entertainment was the thing that people wanted out of these fairs. So essentially what the Coney Island people did was they brought the most popular attraction to the beach.
So how does that work? I mean, you mentioned that it looked like the Eiffel Tower. It does. If the Eiffel Tower were sort of peeled down like a banana a bit, when that's working again, how will it work?
What happens is there are cables connected to the top of it, which flouts out. And people get on the parachutes on a seat. They're pulled up. Would make me very sick. And then once you reach the top, guess what? Dropped. And if all things work well, you float down to the bottom.
What's interesting is that today we have in modern resorts the kind of latter-day version of that, which are the parasail rides and the sort of parachutes where you're pulled along by motorboats, where there's something really monumental and architectural that isn't going anywhere.
This was monumental, and it was exactly as you say. This was the next step after New York City. The great skyscrapers of New York City were rising higher and higher as Coney Island used that technology and brought it out to this here suburb.
So in its kind of leisure fantasy way, this was like a mirror image of the city that was rising 10 miles away.
It was the skeleton of the city, really. You know, it's all based in that turn of the century Victorian Art Nouveau sensibility that leads into the Industrial Age aesthetic that then goes into the Mechanical Age. All of that stuff is here, and this is a real wellspring for design as physical entity and as a kind of mythology.
So unlike Disney World with its pseudo turn-of-the-century Main Street, the real thing is right here.
This is the real thing. You don't need to go to Disney World, Disneyland, or any of the other lands. Coney Island is it.
Stephen Heller, thank you very much.
Thanks, Kurt.
Stephen Heller is the author of several thousand design books, which you couldn't hope to read if you spent all summer reading them.
You're my Coney Island baby. Means so much to me. You're my pretty little lady. I love you tenderly.
I'm Kurt Anderson, and we have brought Studio 360 to Coney Island. My guests today are John Flansburg and John Linnell. In other words, the wonderful band They Might Be Giants. They have been playing together for more than 20 years, and on the Studio 360 boombox here on the beach today, I've got what is now, surely, their best-known song.
Wow, that's loud.
Cool.
And
it's
appropriate.
And that's, of course, is You're Not the Boss of Me, which is the theme song for Malcolm in the Middle. Both of you live in Brooklyn?
Yes,
that's right.
And here we are in Brooklyn.
Yeah. Yes.
Are you guys regular Coney Island habitués?
Yeah, I came here last year to go to the Coney Island Museum, which is a whole other kind of cultural center, but that's a real nighttime freak show rather than the daytime Coney Island boardwalk freak show. But Coney Island is so different than a lot of other
freak shows.
Beach places, you know, it's very bluesy in a way.
I've come here in the wintertime, and it's a really rarefied scene here then, because most everything is shut, but it's got a real vibe.
People talk at all kinds of beaches and all kinds of islands about, oh, winter is the time to be there.
It's right. A dark scene.
Yeah.
It's very
winter in Maine, it really gets you to the, you know, the Katharine Hepburn in your soul.
Right.
I don't know. I mean, we're East Coast people, and We're not player haters. We, you know, we love the West Coast and everything, but there is something very, very seasonal about the life on the beach on the East Coast. And I think, you know, loving the beach as a New Englander is like, it's not that different than being a Red Sox fan or something. You know, ultimately it's gonna go terribly wrong come September.
You obviously work hard. You tour a lot. You make music. You made this film Gigantic, the documentary celebrating yourselves and your lives. In Gigantic, there's a wonderful moment in the film, a piece of tape from when you were playing on The Tonight Show with Doc Severinsen.
Right.
Was that just sort of goofy and wonderful to
It was very exciting.
It was utterly nerve-wracking. At the time, it seemed like a disaster, and seeing the clip in AJ's movie was a big surprise, because I my memory was that we had completely screwed it up. We played the thing really fast, and it just seemed like the most nerve-wracking experience of our lives. And actually, we looked very comfortable on the screen for some reason.
And, of course, in that instance, you played with the whole brass section, and I'm very happy to report that you've brought a big brass section today.
Yes, including Mark Pender from The Conan Show. So that'll be cool.
Let's head over to the Coney Island Museum, where your band is. And we get to walk toward this amazing vista of new and old and kind of crappy and wonderful Astroland, rocket ships, and a great Ferris wheel.
Wonder Wheel. But the cyclone is no longer with us, is it?
No, that's the cyclone right there. That wooden roller coaster.
Which is so dwarfed by modern, gigantic Six Flags-style roller coaster.
Yeah.
But much more terrifying if you've ridden it, because
it's much more dangerous.
Because it's made out of wood, it makes way more racket, and you have a real sense that you could very easily die.
Yeah.
See, but it seems to me now that it is not as decrepit as it was a few years ago. It's right at a good level of ramshackleness.
Right.
Not too slick, but not too depressingly messed up.
Well, Coney Island and Asbury Park and all these other kind of East Coast places, they're always getting the, like, oh, it's coming back. And you never know what to think, you know. Is it really going to come back?
Was it ever there?
Right.
Yeah. Right. Apparently, I mean, when it started, it was considered this incredibly disreputable place. Because originally it was where sailors came to visit prostitutes, I guess. And
for the record, I see no sailors or prostitutes.
Yeah, they've moved on.
No. All right, we're entering the very narrow and steep hallway up the stairs to the Coney Island Museum here. Hey, fellas. We're in the main room of the Coney Island Museum where all the shows happen, the burlesque shows and everything else.
But we can still, out the window here, see the cyclone roller coaster beyond.
Yes.
And if you really stand on your tiptoes, I think even see the edge of the ocean.
But keeping with the feeling of modern-day Brooklyn, they've made sure that the windows actually do not open on this 90-degree day.
There's enough equipment here for a symphony orchestra, and I guess you guys should plug it in and tune it up and get ready to go.
Yeah. The They Might Be Giants Tiny Symphony is about to begin. Okay, so are we ready? Are we ready now? Shall we record it?
What are we going to hear first?
This first song is entitled Idlewild, and it's kind of a dream of a perfect day in New York City sometime in the past.
It's all yours.
Sideshow at Steeplechase Bar. Test your strength, guess your weight. La la la. La la la. La la la. La la la. Take a trip in a sky.
That is They Might Be Giants. John Linnell, John Flansburg, and your magnificent band, whom you will introduce to us.
Well, that's Nathan Durham on the tuba, Mr. Dan the Machine Levine on the trombone, Mark the Love Man Pender on the
that's right.
trumpet.
You
and
can hear the police sirens just as you introduce
right.
Mark.
Right. Car 54, where is he? And of course, Marty Beller on the drums, on the tiny drums. Thank you, Marty.
I'm Kurt Anderson here with They Might Be Giants. In a minute, we'll meet a guy who makes sandcastles that are truly awesome. So stay with us. This is Studio 360, very near the sand and the beach, from PRI, Public Radio International. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson, and today we're at Coney Island with John Flansburg and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants. And we're going to hear some more music from them in a few minutes, but first we're going to hear a story from a beach about 3,000 miles due west of here. Kirk Rademacher calls himself a sand sculptor, which means he makes really ambitious architecture out of sand, with arches and balconies and the whole deal. Fantastical structures that are as high as 10 feet. The King of Sandcastles showed off his skills for us at Ocean Beach in San Francisco.
Sand sculpture is great. It's like sketching in 3D. You can get an image really quickly. You can quickly put up a large block of sand. I use these cylindrical forms here, two of them here. I packed the sand inside of them. Lots of sand, lots of water, not just damp sand, but like soupy sand. The water drains out. Here, let me get a little more sand in there. There's plenty of it out here. It's for free. You're out here on the beach where everything's temporary. People walk differently on the beach, and they're not going anywhere. They're just there, you know, for that moment. And so the art that you make here on the beach is the same thing. It's just here, and then it's gone. It's just, I likes the sunlight here. Little balcony. It's like I'm a little kid here again, making my own fort. My own little fantasy world here. Oh, here makes some stairs here coming up through. Down to that arch there. I was used to art being a really a solitary endeavor, you know. I came to the beach to do this. Hi there.
I like your sandcastle.
Oh, thank you. It's like a sociable art form. You know, I come out here, and it's like traveling. I meet people, I talk to people, and that's part of it.
You want to get another one going on the side of here?
Yeah! This is cool.
They're cutting stale mashed potatoes. You guys playing your food?
Yeah!
You do?
Sometimes. Sometimes. I'm making the road.
They have a wall here that's maybe an inch and a half thick. I want to see air. I want to see a space through it. Just like a kid, you know, who they always want to dig a tunnel, you know.
You want to make a hole in here?
Yeah, from one side to the other. That's all I'm doing here. It's going all the way through. I love doing that.
What do you do this? Okay, if anyone makes this thing break, it's not really their fault. We'll just have to refill it.
It's a combination of all of my favorite things. You know, it's people, it's nature, and it's art. It's all rolled into one. It's the perfect art gallery.
The sand sculptor Kirk Rademacher on Ocean Beach in San Francisco. You can see pictures of some of his work at studio360.org. Jonathan Mitchell produced our story, and I'm Kurt Anderson at Coney Island today with John Flansburg and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants.
Yo, yo, yo.
What do you think of an artist who basically just does this childhood thing as his art?
What are you trying to say with that question?
Well, can you imagine doing it, or do you feel as though you're doing it?
I think if you're in a rock band, it's pretty much a Peter Pan existence.
Well, except I mean the one kind of interesting difference is, like, we actually get to do this thing for posterity. You know, I think it was actually Sarah Vowell who said, "You guys, in a way, are kind of cheating death with this." And the thing, obviously, with the sandcastle guy is, it's gone, you know.
Although, as he suggests, in the end, it all goes away.
Right,
exactly.
Right. And there's a lot of, you know, I guess it's, there's a lot of joy in that, you know. I feel like, I mean, we do a lot of stuff that is just kind of, you know, broadcasting. It's just in the air, and then it's over. I mean, in some ways, I feel like live shows are essentially the musical equivalent of sandcastles.
Well, and what he said about the way people, I think, regard, you know, cool sculptures and alligators and fish and castles on the beach is really true. They have time. They're not going anywhere, so they spend more time looking at those and admiring those than when they're in the Museum of Modern Art and looking at the piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's absolutely a fantastic way to see something.
Well, and speaking of children's things, your last record was at least ostensibly, a children's record, but it seems as great and funny and interesting and cool to me as any of your supposedly adult records.
Yeah, it's pretty much follows in the sort of, you know, psychedelic legacy of They Might Be Giants' work. We felt like it was very important that it really work as a creative record, you know, for kids. I mean, it's to be part of a kid's childhood is like a huge honor. You know, you're really presenting them with some of the first stuff that they're going to ever think about. So it's, in some ways, it's a much bigger responsibility than, you know, just making a regular rock record.
I think it's time for another song. What's this one called?
Well, this one is also about the beach. It's actually it's based on a book about finding buried treasure in Casco Bay, Maine, written by a complete crackpot, and he uses a metal detector, and so this song is based on that.
Let's hear it.
Down at the shore, there's a place where there's no one vacationing. There's just the sound of the call of the wild, overcoming the fear of the unknown. and I've got something to help you understand. Something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Look past the squawking gull. Look past the volleyball. Ignore the mountain of discarded folder all. 'Cause I've got something to help you understand. Something waiting there beneath the land. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Story to tell if you're listening. And underneath every shell there's a story as well. If you've heard enough of the sea, then everything on the top will just suddenly stop seeming interesting. So listen now to the sound of the things that are found underground. Understand something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine. Look past the squawking gull. Look past the volleyball. Ignore the mountain of discarded folderol. 'Cause I've got something to help you understand. Something waiting there beneath the sand. My metal detector is with me all of the time. I'm the inspector over the mine.
They might be giants, John Linnell and John Flansburgh, playing the song Metal Detector, which speaks to my childhood. I didn't have a metal detector, but just for the lack of the dollars, I had a giant thing called a big ear that allowed me to listen to other people's conversations.
Oh, man. So, I didn't even have one of those.
Yeah, no, I was that kind of obsessive nerd that song is about, I think. That reminds me of a lot of your music in the way that it's, on one level, it's sort of fun and bouncy, but as you listen closely, there's a worm in the apple. Is that fair?
I think it's not that's not the specific plan, but that often is what we wind up with. You know, I think we write lyrics based on an idea, and we write the music based on kind of more of a mood. You know, and they often are not strictly linked, you know. So the effect of the music and the words is, you know, they're kind of running in slightly different directions.
But as a effect of your process, but obviously it's deliberate over time, right?
Yeah. I mean, I think at our best, there's always a certain element of compressed thought in the lyric writing. And I think by its nature, it's inviting to, you know, people who want to examine it. But you know, it's a real, you know, writing a good song is a very strange balancing act. It's a really weird kind of confection. You know, you don't know what part is going to be enough to like leave all the other considerations alone. And sometimes, you know, really, I mean, basically a simple idea is often the best one.
And this literally begins with the idea of this sort of dedicated, determined, maybe obsessive guy alone on a beach with his metal detector?
Well, there's this, like I said, there's this particular book which was written by somebody who must be out of his mind because it was written for a Vanity Press, and he describes how to look for buried treasure in this very specific part of Maine.
Not known for its treasure?
Not particularly, and he's just describing, he's basically just talking about his own experience, you know. And for some reason, he's written it as a book for others who may want to follow in exactly the footsteps he is laying down.
But what began as a Vanity Press book is now, you know, a pop hit.
I don't know. I feel like we're closer to that guy than we are to the pop hit.
The next story we're going to listen to is about the darker side of the beach, too, but it's sort of sexy. Paul Delvaux was a painter who painted his beach fantasy in 1942. It's called Village of the Mermaids. The foreground tells one story, but in the distance there's another story, a surprise. Judith Kempfner went into the vaults of the Art Institute of Chicago to see Delvaux's painting, along with curator Stephanie D'Alessandro.
The painting is actually based on a dream that Delvaux had, an image that haunted him, and in a way, this is an image that haunted you.
This art institute did a very unusual thing. It wrote to the painter and said, "Oi, what's this all about?"
Yeah, and Delvaux, surprisingly, wrote us back a 2-page letter and explained exactly what the village was, exactly what the title was, exactly who those women were, and told us the whole story of the origin of the painting.
May 17, 1956. Dear Sir, I have received your kind letter of May 7th. I will try to give you the information you ask for on the subject of the Village of the Mermaids. I was inspired for the subject by a dream. In a strange street, there was a succession of closed doors. In front of each door, seated on a chair in the faked style of Louis XVI, in gilded wood, sits a woman dressed in a long robe with a high collar. The woman sits absolutely motionless, with her hands on her knees like a doorkeeper. Each woman wears a robe of different color, each has long hair of different color, blonde or brown, and each chair is different from the other. The street extends far into the background and leads to a beach which is surrounded by white mountains.
Immediately, the street starts to fall forward and then to the right. On the left-hand side, there's 5 women. Every single one of them is sitting in a high-backed sort of ornamental chair. I think that something else that I would probably look at that would help me to sort of figure out what's going on is there's a man fully dressed. He has a hat on, a coat, top coat, and he's walking away from these women. And on his left side is a very tall wall, and on the other side of this wall we can see 20-30, who knows how many, to me there's a sense of just many mermaids coming from a beach and going out into the water. There's a few that are sort of out there already, and it's just a completely mysterious, enchanting image.
What is going on here? The women in their long robes and long hair, who were sitting in front of their doors just a moment ago, are transported to the beach and freed from their robes and are suddenly revealed as beautiful mermaids who are plunging into the waves where they disappear for good.
I think that he gets at that in the way that that deep perspective pulls us through to the next part of his dream, which is from those women in dresses to those mermaids. He got at it by the way that he created that depth and that roll of the street through the village.
I guess the eroticism of it is the contrast between the clothed women and the naked mermaids, well, half-naked mermaids. They've sort of got low-slung tails. Mm-hmm. The eroticism may be also in the quantity of women outnumbering this poor little man.
Mm-hmm. I think also part of the eroticism is in the secret that's just tantalizingly on the other side of the wall. Rugged mountains,
unsculptured, untamed, uncivilized beach scene and women in their true reality. This beach, it's glistening. It's bright. The water's clear. The mountains and the sand are very brightly illuminated. There's a wonderful sense of freedom, of liberation, of peace. To say joy is maybe too much, but there's a wonderful hope and peacefulness in that scene, that beach scene that's just in the distance.
All this is found in the picture, and yet I was hoping to preserve the complete mystery. The big women with their long hair have moved towards the beach and, dropping their long robes, are plunging into the water, which is green and transparent, and then that's all. The beach is deserted. And so is the street with the closed doors. Here, then, are some notes, a charming story which I have attempted to put into a painting as a composer might try to put to music a lovely poem. Sincerely, Paul Delvaux.
For Studio 360, I'm Judith Kampfner.
You can see Paul Delvaux's Village of the Mermaids online at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson with the band They Might Be Giants out at Coney Island today, listening to songs and stories about the beach. John, you were looking at a reproduction of this picture right now. The whole description of it and the picture itself certainly is not what we Americans in our kind of Frankie and Annette way think of as the beach, is it?
No, it seems like it's a terrific summary of 20th century surrealism.
Are mermaids an appealing idea to you? I mean, we're here at the Coney Island Museum in Coney Island. There's a big mermaid tradition as part of the
mythology. That's to me is completely weird. I mean, the whole idea of mermaids as erotic is really weird, I think, because they don't apparently have...
Well, to second base...
You can get to second base, yeah.
But then, we're talking about second base on PRI.
That's right. But that's where it ends, pretty much.
Well, I feel like I really don't understand the unknowable aspect of the mermaid and its mythology.
Although Daryl Hannah in Splash.
Yeah, where does that come from?
I don't know. Well, I mean, it comes from being out on the sea for months and years at a time in the 19th century, I suppose. And, you know... your hopes about a fish and your sadness about
I get it. Yeah. No, that's good.
What you've left.
I like where you're going.
Well, it also strikes me...
That fish is looking nice.
Exactly. And I'm not just talking fish sticks either.
Right.
That fish is lonely, like me. Finally, someone who understands me.
You have another song for us.
Yes.
What is it?
This is off the Beach Boys album Pet Sounds, and it's called Caroline No.
So this is by the Beach Boys.
This is by Brian Wilson with the Beach Boys. Yes.
Let's hear it.
Where did your long hair go? Where is the girl I used to know? How could you lose that happy glow? Caroline, no. Who took that look away? I remember how you used to say you'd never change, but that's not true. That made me love you so much then. Could we ever get them back once they had gone? Oh, Caroline.
I'm Kurt Anderson in Studio 360. That was John Flansburgh singing, I guess, the Brian Wilson part.
Yeah, we were talking about that. Actually, we were wondering if it's Carl Wilson or Brian Wilson, because they both have similar voices. Sometimes Carl does the sort of...
Carl sings the hard ones, I think.
Yeah.
And that was John Linnell playing the accordion on
that
tune.
Yeah, which I think Brian played the accordion on the original.
Which one of you is the Brian Wilson of They Might Be Giants?
Oh.
I think I'm the Dennis. And
yeah.
John
I do a pretty good Mike Love when it really gets down to it. But I don't know. I can't imagine what it's like to work with somebody like Brian Wilson, you know, when people talk about that circumstance. You know, I can't imagine. You know, we have such a practical kind of rolling down the highway sort of relationship and work experience, you know. I mean, it seems like...
There's none of the he's the genius nut visionary, yeah, keep away from him.
There's no, wait, I've got a vision. Everyone shut up.
No, we worked the nut angle pretty well all around. You know, that definitely serves. You know, you look, at a certain point, you realize that kind of thing will be rewarded if, you know, it keeps people at arm's length.
John Flansburgh and John Linnell, They Might Be Giants. They're my guest today. I'm Kurt Anderson at Coney Island. In a minute, we'll look at Capiz, Art on the Half Shell. That's ahead here on the beach with Studio 360 from PRI, Public Radio International. I'm Kurt Anderson with John Linnell and John Flansburgh, otherwise known as the band They Might Be Giants. We are at the beach today, or at least in a stifling room very, very close to the beach, the Coney Island Museum here on Surf Avenue in Brooklyn, New York. And we've come indoors so we don't get, I guess, sand in the tuba.
Or sunburned or anything.
Do either of you guys make a habit of picking up stuff along the beach as you're walking around?
Yeah, actually, I have to say, last time I was at the beach, we collected stones and went home and made some mobiles for our house out of stones gathered on the beach.
Really? How do you hook the stone onto a wire?
You know, my wife has got some jewelry making equipment, and we made some Calder-esque things with some driftwood and stones, and they're in our bathroom, and they look very inappropriate, but they're full of spirit.
And if I see them on eBay, I'll know where they came from. Well, we're going to hear a story now from a place where seashells are more than souvenirs and where they're indeed Calder-like works of art, I guess. They are part of the economy there and serious art. Jocelyn Gonzalez explains the history and craft of Capiz, which is a traditional Philippine art form.
For you, the sound of the sea might be this. But for me, it's this. These are Capiz shells. When I was growing up, one reminder of the islands my family left behind were chandeliers made of hundreds of nearly transparent, iridescent clam shells. They seemed to float in our old rooms with an otherworldly light, like sunshine diffused by waves of water. Capiz is from the Pacuna shell, and it's found in the Philippine waters off the southern island of Panay. Every 7 years, the clams come to the end of their natural life cycle, and millions of the shells wash up on the shores at low tide. While the fishermen sell off the meat as a delicacy, the shells are sold to artisans.
So out of that, they would make jewelries, decorations, and window frames.
Esther Andaya remembers Capiz's artwork from her childhood in the Philippines, where the shells were first used by the Spaniards in the 16th century.
You see them a lot in the churches. This one's for, you know, vestibules, decorations inside. Filipino churches, that is, not the foreign ones.
Because these early craftsmen didn't have stone and stained glass, early Filipino churches employed native wood carving and Capiz window panes. The shells were even used in mosaic and religious sculpture. From that point, Capiz got handed down as a decorative element in traditional Filipino homes. The massive red Capiz chandeliers in Esther's New Jersey living room are over 20 years old, and they were given to her by her mother.
Oh, it reminds me of those mansions, the beautiful houses in the Philippines that the rich people have. They are the only ones who can afford them at that time. they are expensive. They are handmade, and those shells are too thin and too delicate to work with. They have to sew them one by one. They use nylon threads for that.
I wondered if anyone in the U.S. worked with these shells, besides the importers selling mass-produced souvenirs over the Internet. I found Gwen Carlton, a designer who decided to try making these intricate fixtures herself.
Well, you know, I used to have a mid-century furniture store a couple of years ago, and I had one of the original Filipino chandeliers hanging in the store, and I had dozens of people want to buy it from me. I just kind of looked at it and thought, well, it's whatever this material is in filament. I mean, I could make that. It was actually kind of hard to find out that much about the shells. It took, you know, kind of a few months even to find out where I could get them. And I just sort of got into some books, and I knew that Werner Panton had made some... They called it the Fun Series in the 60s, where he had used the Capiche shells. So I was familiar with it from there.
Gwen holds a U.S. Fish and Wildlife import-export license to get the shells from the Philippines. After they're harvested, the round 3-inch shells are soaked overnight in water and a mild acid to clean and soften them. Then they're scraped, polished, and cut. Although they're sometimes dyed or glazed, Gwen uses Capiche in their natural shades.
You know, they actually don't really look like shells, I don't think. I think they probably look more like very thin discs of glass, you know. And, you know, individually they're pretty nondescript, but when you get lots and lots of them together, they start having a real sculptural quality to them.
Gwen wanted a very lush presentation of Capiche, so she uses up to 4 or 5 times the amount of shells, perhaps up to 12,000, all hand-knotted with simple fishing line. It can take days or weeks to make one custom fixture. She calls her pieces Hydra Medusa.
Hydra Medusa is the scientific name for jellyfish. One of the interesting things about jellyfish is that they're actually very simple, but what they are essentially are very thin layers of cells that are illuminated from within by their own phosphorescent elements. So in a way, these really are like jellyfish in the sense that the shells are the walls of cells and they are illuminated from within, and they really kind of work like jellyfish work. I think that people are really struck by this material, that they love the sound of them.
The luminous Capiche shells from my childhood were taken down and put away years ago, probably because they seemed dated or too delicate.
For me, in particular, it was so important because, like, these pieces that I have, I keep them for sentimental reason. They're from my mother. They're really nice to look at. It's unique.
For Studio 360, I'm Jocelyn Gonzalez.
You can see some Capiche artwork on our website at studio360.org. I'm Kurt Anderson, back out on the boardwalk, heading toward the beach with John Flansburg and John Linnell of They Might Be Giants.
Listening to that story and thinking about people listening to, you know, peaceful summer sounds, and now that we're in the boom car Jeep environment of New York, it's
kind
of
this is not exactly the idyllic New Age idea of beachdom.
No. Well, and it's, but we got a thumping bass.
We do have that. When I think of beach art, stuff made out of things on the beach, in addition to what I'm sure is your lovely Calder-esque sculpture of stones, I think of driftwood, and I never kind of got driftwood totally as a thing.
Yeah, it's sort of like Sammy Davis Jr. It can be an acquired taste.
You guys obviously are great, amazing craftspeople of pop music. Do you think of each song as a work of craft? Do you refine it? You're trying to push it? Or is it just the thing you do?
No, I think we really think of it as craft. I mean, when we started, we did a lot more improvisational stuff. And in the past few years, since we started working with a live band backing us up, we've kind of gotten back into that because we're more confident about it. But when we started, we kind of were doing a couple of different things, and there's an improvisational element, and then there was like a song structure element, and we just kind of made the decision at a certain point that the strong structure stuff worked a little bit better. It just allowed us to focus more. But, you know, you're constantly evolving as a songwriter, and you kind of can't – it would be nice to think you could just do, if you simply did the same thing over and over again and kept on crafting similar ideas, you would just get better at it. But it doesn't – unfortunately, it doesn't really work that way. I mean, you kind of have to – you have to keep on
– setting up
evolving.
New challenges.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's getting really, really hot, too hot. The beach here at Coney Island is full. There are too many people with their shirts off, and I think it's probably time for us to
I see the snake and parrot man is coming this way.
Oh, there's a man with two parrots on his back.
And a snake.
Well, it's an iguana, I think, more. Oh, and a snake as well.
Oh, I didn't see the iguana. Yeah,
oh,
he's
God.
Got a, he's got a boa constrictor, an iguana, and two parrots.
He's a walking jungle.
That doesn't seem to be what he's doing. He's taking pictures of people.
Well, I guess you get to, like, you can have your selection of whatever...
No, I think those are just the clothes he normally wears, and he's in some completely different line of business. That's just what he put on this morning when he left the house.
John Linnell, John Flansburgh, thank you very, very much for playing
thanks.
For us and talking to us. We've got one more song from They Might Be Giants to close the show. What is it going to be?
This song is called Boat of Car. It's a special arrangement for a little wind group. Sung by Mr. John.
That makes Flesberg. No sense, Boat of Car. You know that, right?
Boat of Car. Well, make of it what you will.
Well, you can hear all of They Might Be Giants beach songs at studio360.org, along with all the stories we've ever done on the show. We want to thank today, before we hear They Might Be Giants play again, Dan Levine, Nathan Durham, Marty Beller, Mark Pender, Ed Haber, Irene Trudell, and Paul Ruest, and the staff of the Coney Island Museum. Thanks also to Lou Malazzi, the actor you heard in the story about the Village of the Mermaids.
Daddy sang bass. Daddy sang bass.
I took my boat for a car. I took that car for a ride. I was trying to get somewhere, but now I'm following the traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat of car.
Daddy sang bass.
Traces of your fingernails that run along the windshield on the boat of car. On the boat of car. On the boat of car. On the boat of car.
That was They Might Be Giants playing Boat of Car, recorded live for us at Coney Island. As it turns out, this is the last summer for the old Astroland Amusement Park, home of the Cyclone roller coaster. The 80-year-old roller coaster itself is landmarked, but the park was bought recently by developers who plan to transform Coney Island into a Las Vegas-y resort. It's the beginning of the end of an era for the charmingly decrepit place that we've known. So if you want to get a feel for the Coney Island of yore, right now is the time to visit. But let's not end on a sad note. Instead, we'll leave you with a track from They Might Be Giants' brand new record, The Else. This tune is called The Cap'em.
Do you think there's somebody out there? Probably think
I'm Kurt Anderson. Thank you very much for listening today, and please join us again for next week's show. Studio 360 is produced by WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Julie Burstein,
Lital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Michelle Siegel,
Derek John,
Jenny Lawton,
Pike Medinowski,
Sarah Lilly,
Rob Weisberg,
Carrie Hillman,
Peter Clowney,
Ave Carrillo,
Andy Lancet,
Deanna Kashani,
Sean Wen,
Kim Gittleson.
And our theme music is by David Van Tiegel.
Studio 360 is funded in part by Ken and Lucy Lehman, supporting CARE in its efforts to alleviate global poverty, on the web at care.org, and the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes that a great nation deserves great art.
PRI, Public Radio International.
What's it like becoming more famous than your famous jazz musician father?
He's one of the greatest saxophonists, in my opinion, of all time, but, you know, struggled and didn't have the opportunities that I had.
Jazz phenom Joshua Redman emerges from his father's shadow only to cast his own.
It wasn't fair. I didn't think it was fair.
I'm Kurt Anderson. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI.